brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
It's fun to go back to the drawing board each offseason. Okay, did we put our team in the best position to be successful? What's the plan going to be going forward? And I think so much of it has to do with personnel. And everybody says it, but it's so true. Like, it's all about players. Good players make coaches look better. And they're the ones who make the shots. They're the ones who affect the game defensively. And you just try to put them in the right positions to be successful. And then get out of the way.
Mike McSloy just completed his first season as the Drew University men's basketball head coach, finishing above 500 in 2022-2023, leading the Rangers to a 13-12 record. He took over at Drew following a stint at St. Joseph's University, Long Island, where he served as the head coach of the Golden Eagles from 2019 to 2022. Prior to his arrival at St. Joseph's, McSloy served as an assistant men's basketball coach at Gettysburg College for the 2018-2019 season. From 2016 to 2018, McSloy was an assistant coach at New York University. Additionally, McSloy held assistant coaching positions at Vassar, Connecticut College, and SUNY Maritime before working at NYU. McSloy played two seasons as a junior and a senior from 2010 to 2012 at SUNY Maritime and spent the previous two seasons as a player at SUNY Oswego. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, I'm Dan Krikorian.
And I'm Patrick Carney.
And we're Slapping Glass. And you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. You'll want to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Mike McSloy, men's basketball head coach at Drew University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to be joined by Mike McSloy, the head men's basketball coach at Drew University. Mike, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your basketball career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Yeah, so I grew up on Long Island. You know, it's funny, everybody says on Long Island, but, you know, I first started playing just like in the street with my older brother. He's 3 years older than me. We had a pretty neat setup where, like, we had a lot of connecting streets, a lot of guys around our age. And we started at a young age just playing outside through all hours of the day. We had a street light above our hoop. That was not there on purpose, but it worked out. So we were able to play pretty late at night. And then I got, you know, from there, I was just playing like in-house stuff as a kid. And then early on, I was able to start playing some AAU, which back then, you know, for every AAU program, there was only like one or two teams. So it was a little bit more selective than it is nowadays.
Growing up on Long Island, did you have a favorite college or pro player that you followed?
You know, it's funny. So I was my grandfather had season tickets to the New York Islanders hockey team. And back then they played on what's called the Sports Channel, which is the same channel that the New Jersey Nets played on. And so I would watch like the Islanders games, but I would also, I guess, just end up watching the Nets games as well. And Stefan Marbury was awesome. He was a great player. And I actually wore 33. He was 33 on the Nets. I wore 33 in high school because of him. My dad thought it was because of Larry Bird and had to break his heart a little bit and tell him that it was Stephon Marbury, you know, the two colored shoes and the cradling of the ball when he drove to the basket. I tried to do all those things and I didn't do them well, but yeah, that was my guy growing up.
You couldn't keep that quiet and not break your dad's heart?
Yeah, it's okay.
So I'm assuming as you're playing in the neighborhood, you're playing lots of sports. And obviously, as you said, one of the things that's interesting is just from the AAU side of it, how different it's become, where now basically anybody who plays basketball is playing AAU. But for yourself, was basketball always your number one thing? Or if it wasn't, when did it become sort of your focus?
So basketball was always my number one passion. It was my favorite sport growing up, but I was actually probably a better lacrosse player at a young age. Lacrosse is pretty big on Long Island. Both my cousins played in college. One played at Duke, the other played at Penn State. So it was kind of like a family thing, but you know, my dad tells me the story, but I would play a lacrosse game and then sprint home and sprint to my room and grab my basketball and go back outside and shoot hoops. And it was funny. So after eighth grade, I decided that it was time to, you know, stop playing lacrosse because it started interfering with AAU. And I remember when I told my mom that I was going to quit lacrosse, she actually started crying. She was like, "You're so much better at lacrosse." I was like, "Thanks, Ma." But, you know, basketball is always my passion. I don't know what it is, what it was about it at that age. But it was so enjoyable. And yeah, so I played, I actually tried to end up going back to lacrosse in high school. Not well, like the skill of my friends and teammates just kind of like surpassed me in a huge way. So I tried it out again in 10th grade for 1 year and then focus on hoops all the way through high school.
What'd you do as a high school player once you kind of got out of lacrosse? What did you do to make yourself a better player? What do you remember about your own training regimen and just how you tried to improve and get better?
Yeah. So, I was a late bloomer, I guess. You know, I really didn't start growing into my body, honestly, until probably I graduated high school. I grew an inch after high school, started adding some weight, in college. First it was bad weight. Then I guess it was good weight as I get a little bit older. but in high school, you know, I was mainly focused on, you know, trying to get a little quicker, a little bit more athletic. I feel like that's where I lacked. As a guard in high school, spent a lot of time shooting, working on my ball handling. And, you know, the thing with that is I kind of grew up as a shooter. And as I transitioned into high school, I was trying to focus more on being a point guard. I feel like in order to get recruited back then, I feel like there was a million 6'1", 6'2" shooting guards. But I felt like I was a little unique in the sense that I was kind of a taller point guard, if you would. So when I stopped playing lacrosse, I was, you know, focusing on my foot speed, working on my ball handling a little bit more, trying to get myself in better shape. But it was funny. So in ninth grade, I first AAU practice in that spring. So it's my first year not playing lacrosse and go to AAU practice. I think I'm one of the better guards on the team. So I'm excited. I'm like, all right, this is great. I'm probably going to start the remainder of the spring. And then in the next practice walked Scott Machado, who played at Iona for 4 years, played a little bit in the NBA. And I think he's still playing professionally. And I quickly found out at that practice that I was no longer the starting point guard and that I would be backing him up on a pretty regular basis the rest of the spring. But yeah, good experience, great guy. And there it took me.
As you started to, what's your favorite memory from being a high school basketball player?
Favorite memory. So my sophomore year, this is not the favorite memory, but it'll kind of transition into it. My sophomore year, we went 2-17. I was on varsity, but playing behind some older seniors. And the next year, we turned it around and ended up winning our regional championship and went to the first ever and first only school state Final Four. And this is where social media, I tell our guys on our team this story, you know, pretty often. This is where social media has changed so much. So we're up at the state championships, Final Four in Glens Falls, New York. And we're sitting there, we're playing Peekskill in the second game. And the first game before us is Glens Falls. And I forget who they were playing. Anyway, they stopped the game about halfway through, you know, the first half and presented the ball. And it was the new New York State all-time leading scorer. And it actually ended up being Jimmer Fredette. Now, we went all the way up there and had no idea who this guy was, right? Which would never happen nowadays.
Right.
Social media, Twitter, Instagram, this and that. And I can remember sitting in the stands, my buddies looking at me being like, how are you going to guard that dude? I'm like, well, I'm not, right? Like, it's not going to happen. But it's just amazing how much time has changed. And that was only, 15, 16 years ago.
It is crazy. I mean, I think what's interesting is, as you said, everybody is aware of everybody else. And I think it's hard on kids. I'm sure you see it in your role as a head coach that you're kind of having to deal with it. And I find it to be even more interesting when you start looking at, obviously, at the Division III level and just the recruiting part of it. And then you get guys that are going to school, and obviously everybody kind of knows what's going on because you can check box scores, you can see scores, all that stuff is right there. Versus, again, 15 or 20 years ago, if you wanted to see a box score for a Division III game, you had to really search for it. And
yep.
Conversely, you talk about like the Division I guys, and I can't even imagine being a college basketball player at the highest level and just the amount of feedback, let's just put it kindly, that those players are getting after games on social media and having to try to navigate that, and then have a coaching staff trying to help those players to understand and navigate what it means and what they should be looking at and what they shouldn't be looking at. It just adds to me a whole nother layer of complication that I'm glad back when I was playing that I didn't have to deal with any of that stuff. And I'm guessing you probably feel the same way.
Yeah. I mean, I was telling our couple of our assistants the other day, like everybody nowadays, when they commit to a Division III school, they post on Instagram and Twitter, and it's great. But like if I did that growing up after I committed to a Division III school, like my friends would have made fun, fun of me, right? Just because it wasn't a thing. Like you just like, all right, I'm going to college and off you go. But social media has definitely become so prevalent nowadays, and it definitely adds to the pressure. Like you said, I can't imagine at the highest level like what that looks like, because like you said, every game they're getting scrutinized, and at the end of the day, like. And with NIL, it's changing a little bit because these guys are starting to make some serious money. But at the end of the day, they're still 18 to 23 year old young men, right? And they need a lot of guidance, a lot of help. And these are pretty fragile years in their lives and very important years in their growth. And sometimes I feel like social media and the outside noise can kind of negatively affect that.
Yeah, it has to have an effect. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think that what you have to do as a coach, as a coaching staff, is to just figure out how can you help your guys to navigate it and get the most out of the positive side of it, which there clearly is positive sides to it. But by the same token, you can totally see, I mean, even as an adult, there's times that I go down a rabbit hole of I'm looking at this and all of a sudden I just spent 30 minutes looking at who knows what. And sure. For kids, it's just so alluring to be able to just pull up the phone and look at this or that, or, whatever. I think when the recruiting piece of it, you bring that up, and just in terms of guys knowing where everybody else is going or knowing what other offers everybody's getting. And, for when I was coming, maybe I knew who some of the guys that I played against in my really centralized local area, I knew where they were going to school, but beyond maybe a 20-mile radius, I had no idea. To your point, like, here's Jimmer Fredette. And you guys hadn't even heard of him. I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, I had no idea. And then the other guy that we were playing against was Mookie Jones, who played at Syracuse. We knew a little bit more about him just because I think we scrambled and tried to, get some game tape prior to us playing them. Not that it helped. We didn't fare too well. I think we were down 8.5 and we were feeling good. Like, we're going to get these guys in the second half. And then we ended up losing by more than 30. But nevertheless, an amazing experience. And I think the older I get, the more I look back on it and think that was a really fun time in my life.
I think that the older you get, the more you tend to reminisce and look back and realize that you only get one chance to do that kind of stuff. And I think that that's why athletics, whether you're a player or I think as a parent, I see this a lot, or I think about this a lot, that why do we put so much time into our kids' sports? There's times where I'm like, man, what are we doing? Like, we're spending all this time and this money and we're doing all this. And I think what it comes down to, the more I've thought about it, is that you only get one chance to
to be an athlete. By the time most kids are 18 years old, their formal athletic career is over. And for those of us who are fortunate enough to go on and play beyond high school, once you get beyond college, it obviously the opportunity to play goes down even more. And so I think as a parent, as a kid, when you look back on it, or when you think about it with your own kids, you just want them to take advantage of it, because you know it's such a short period of time in your life. And yet it's one that I'm sure you'll attest to has had such a huge impact on me, and I'm sure you, and just looking at who you are today as a person, probably all traces back to your experiences from sports.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think about my experience probably growing up playing sports every day and kind of how it's shaped me. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't wish that our guys go through the adversity that they do, because it's hard in the moment to see them going through that. But as an athlete specifically, but in the back of my mind, I tell them this too. I say, guys, like, you have no idea. This is going to make you a better person, a better, you know, family member. It's going to make you stronger in your relationships, because you're facing this adversity. And when adversity hits again in your life, and it always will, you're going to have different ways of handling it because of your athletic career. Whether they know it or not in the moment, it definitely helps shape them as they get older.
Yeah, there's no question. I think as coaches, if we take advantage of that opportunity to talk about those things as they happen, and I've often said, and I'm sure you'd agree, that there's a lot of things that are said that we don't necessarily appreciate right in the moment, but 5-10 years down the road, you know that that's going to have an impact. And I think about things that happened to me that, again, in the moment I looked at it and was like, ugh, you know, this is tough, or this isn't what I hoped it would be. And then 5-10 years down the road, you're like, oh yeah, I get it. I understand what that coach was saying, or I understand what I learned from that particular experience. And that's the power that sports has, that I don't think there's really anything else out there that a lot of people participate in that has the same type of impact that sports can have, just because it's such a visceral experience in terms of it's so intense, and there's winning and losing, and there's doing it in public, and all these things that kind of go along with it that really make sports just such a unique experience that allows you to grow as a human being, and eventually be able to reflect on that as you get to be an adult and get older and maybe have a little bit more perspective. So it's interesting to think back on your own experiences, which we don't often get to do. I know that so often for me, I'm caught up in the day-to-day of what's going on, that it's not all that often I get to go back and reminisce and think about my days as an athlete. But when I do, clearly I know that it had a huge impact on me. Tell us a little bit about your college decision. You mentioned earlier that you kind of had it on your mind when you dropped out of lacrosse that, hey, I want to be able to maybe play some basketball beyond high school and play in college. So what did that process look like for you?
Yeah, I think up at the State Final Four is when I started to get recruited a little bit. You know, at that time, a lot of the upstate SUNY schools, Oswego, Cortland, Oneonta, you know, went to those games, and different than nowadays, right? Like, again, just to compare a little bit, like the huddle accounts, the highlight tapes, they really didn't exist. So I got some feedback a little bit from that tournament, and kept in contact with those coaches. And I remember I narrowed it down to pretty quickly Oswego and Cortland. And I went up and visited Oswego in October. And I went to their practice. Coach Broderick was the head coach at the time. And then now he's at Nazareth College. So I visited Oswego, and then I visited Cortland soon after. I think the same weekend, actually. I just loved Coach Broderick and Coach Farden, who's still there as an assistant. I felt like they were just really genuine guys. They showed a lot of interest in me, and I loved the way they played. You know, a little bit different back then was they shot so many threes, and I just thought, like, it was so cool in practice, like, watching these guys get up and down, they're shooting threes. They spent a lot of time, like, just in breakdown drills and getting a lot of threes up. And it was funny, like, we got home, and me and my dad went up on the trip, and we got back, and on Monday morning, he left for work, but he left a note on my desk, and it was like, call coach and tell him that you want to come. And it was early, right? Like SUNY schools, I think even nowadays, like still don't get guys to commit that early. But basically my dad was like, if you found where you want to go, don't mess with it. Like if you think it's a place where you're going to be happy, give a coach a call and tell him that you want to come. So picked up the phone, and back then it was the house phone. I don't even know if I had a cell phone at that point, but called the coach and told him I want to come. And yeah, that's kind of how it, that's kind of how it shook out, which was definitely a great decision.
What were you thinking about in terms of what you wanted to study when you first went to school?
Oh man, it's so funny. So the one thing I love about Drew is they don't allow incoming freshmen to be a declared major. So when I went up there, it was all in my intent to become a teacher. I was like, I'm going to become a teacher and coach, probably at the elementary level, teach and then coach at the high school level, was like kind of like what my plan was going into my freshman year. And then after 2 years, I decided to transfer, and I transferred to SUNY Maritime, which is a very specific school. Basically all the students who graduate from SUNY Maritime end up like sailing and going out to sea and either working on oil tankers or oil rigs or tugboats. And I remember when I was going to SUNY Maritime, like that was the new plan. And then I, you know, that was a very short lasted plan. I ended up switching my major yet again to international trade. And then you fast forward soon after college, like I'm doing nothing that pertains to my degree. I'm coaching basketball. I don't regret any of it because I feel like, again, each of those decisions kind of like led me to my passion and what I really wanted to do, you know, in life after college.
So how'd you get into coaching? Was that something that you started looking and you're like, oh, okay, I got this degree, but man, I don't know that this is what I want to do. And I want to go into coaching. I know you kind of went into college with that idea. I'm assuming it was still kind of always in the back of your mind, but just talk about the actual transition and how you get that first job.
Yeah. So what had happened was I finished my fourth year. I finished my eligibility, but I still had to do another year of school because when I transferred, I lost a bunch of credits in the transition. And SUNY Maritime was in the process of hiring a brand new coach. And it was pretty cool. It was a pretty cool experience. They, I guess, wanted a player involved in the search, even though I wasn't returning with eligibility. They kind of let me sit on the coaching search and the interview process. And thinking back, like that was such a great experience. I really wish I knew in the moment, like just soak it all in and listen to what these guys are saying. But nevertheless, SUNY Maritime hired Jake Scott, who had been there for a little while. Then he went to SUNY Cobleskill, and now he's at Cayuga. And I kind of expressed to all the candidates in the interview process like that I wanted to help out in any way that I could. And I remember he wrote me a handwritten note and he was like, if I get the job, you can definitely, you know, help me out and be an assistant. So I remember like, not that I got on the job by any means, but when his name got brought up in the wrap ups, I was all for him.
There's some backroom deals going on there. It sounds like
a little backroom deals, a little agenda on my end, I guess.
I like it. That's the way life works.
I know. Yeah. And it was great. It was amazing. So what had happened was he basically, you know, I was still an undergrad, still taking classes. But he kind of threw me to the fire, like let me watch film with him. Let me get out a little bit and recruit. And thinking back, like I'm still making mistakes, but back then I probably made a million mistakes and probably made his job in his first year harder than easier, which is not what you want from an assistant.
Right.
But I remember like just being in practice, and we didn't have a good record that year by any means, but I was like, all right, I can wear shorts and a t-shirt to work every day. I can be around basketball. And if I can make this into a living, like there it is, there's a dream. And I remember I called my dad and I was like, I think I want to coach. He's like, that's great. Like after work. And I was like, no, I want to do this full time. And that was kind of my start. And I guess I haven't looked back since.
What was it like to coach at the school where you had just played? So clearly you're on the staff and some of your previous teammates, you're coaching now. Now, granted, again, you're not the head coach and you're a first year guy, but just what do you remember about that experience and just sort of the transition from, I always think it's interesting to go from being a player in a program to being a coach in the same program where you kind of get to go behind the scenes. So just what was it like to sort of elevate yourself from player to coach within a program that you were already familiar with?
I think it was eye-opening, right? Eye-opening experience for me. Like, you know, I never knew what the day-to-day entailed for a coach. And I never knew how much like thought went into like each decision, whether it be like what we were going to do for practice, how we were going to prepare for games, like all the ins and outs and details that went into recruiting. So I think like the first thing was I was just like wide-eyed and like, wow, this is very different than I expected in a good way. And then it was just, you know, it was difficult, right? Like you're friends with some of these guys, you played with them for a couple of years. But now you're their coach and you're supposed to be the one giving instruction. So that definitely took me a little bit of a while to get used to. The good thing was after my year of eligibility, a lot of the guys were no longer on the team. So outside of a few guys, it was pretty much a new crop of players that we were coaching.
Gotcha. All right. So after that year is up, then you get an opportunity to go to Connecticut College. How did that opportunity come your way after that first year at SUNY Maritime?
So I went and this is what I tell like young assistants all the time, like any opportunity to work camp, whether you get paid or not, go take it. So another Kings Park guy where I grew up, Justin Simon, is the assistant coach at Yale University. They always ran their Yale Elite camps. And I reached out to him and I was like, hey, like, do you have any openings at camp? Like, I would love to come work. And he was like, it's not glamorous. It's volunteer and you're going to have to ref. And I was like, sure, I'll do it. That sounds great. So I go up there and my senior year of eligibility, we actually had played Connecticut College. And I just saw the coach there, Tom Satcher, and I went over and said hello. And at the time, his assistant was Chris McHugh, who's the head coach now at Washington and Lee. And they had called me soon after and they were like, hey, listen, you know, we have a new part-time spot. It's not, you know, it doesn't pay a lot of money, but if you're interested in interviewing for it, we would love to get you on the phone and talk more about it. So we talked about it, had a good conversation. Coach offered me the job, but it was, you know, so little pay. And I can't believe like if I could go back in time, I never would have turned it down. I don't know what I was thinking, but I just was like, hey, coach, like I would love the opportunity, but I just don't know if I can survive on the, you know, moving up there and survive on this, on the low pay. And he's like, I totally understand. Fast forward, that was in June. So you fast forward now to like the end of August, like the last week. And he called me back and he's like, hey, you know, Chris just got the full-time assistant job at Emory. And, you know, would you be interested in coming up for an interview for his spot? And I was like, yeah, I was like, I can come tomorrow. And he's like, sounds good. I go up there, interview with coach, and he offered me the job the next day. So I remember I was on the phone with him and I was like, when do you need me up there? And he's like, I need you here yesterday. So all of a sudden, like in 4 days, I'm completely moved into a new place in Connecticut. You know, it was an amazing, like that experience was so awesome. And, you know, I was there for 2 years with coach and I lived in a house with a bunch of other assistants within the department about a quarter mile away from campus. And I would spend all day in the office and try to learn as much as I could. And coach was so gracious with his time. Like, you know, he really taught me what it was like to be a coach, taught me how to recruit, taught me how to scout, taught me how to handle myself on the road, told me how to coach in practice, how to find my voice. And those 2 years like completely solidified, like, this is what I want to do. I couldn't imagine doing anything else after that.
When you think about that 2 year period, what's one or two things that stand out to you that you still feel are a really important part of who you are as a coach?
Yeah, that's a great question. One or two things that really stood out. I think what you put into it is what you get out of it. Is one thing. So like, you know, when I was there as an assistant, I spent a lot of time and I think things have changed since then. Like you can do a lot of work. You don't always have to be in the office 24/7. But I think just being available for the players was something that at that time I really prided myself on. And I still do to this day. I feel like, you know, we're here to coach, but we're also here to be mentors and be a support system for them. And I think just sometimes just being around, you know, is comforting for them. So that's something I try to still carry over to this day. And then the other thing would probably be, so much of coaching is about relationships, right? And how you treat players is super important. I firmly believe, like, the better you treat them, the more you'll get out of them every single day. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I would say I took from those 2 years. But I mean, I learned so much, like I said before, from coach, just the ins and outs of how to run a program, how to scout, how to recruit, especially how to recruit was probably the biggest thing that I learned from him. And, you know, I just thought it was like, oh, I'd call a guy and he'd commit. Like, there's so much more, there's so much more that goes into it. And it's so rewarding when that guy finally calls you and tells you he's coming.
What's the hardest part of the learning curve when it comes to recruiting, when you, for you yourself, or if you're working with a young coach that's just kind of getting into it, what do you have to learn? What do you have to know? What about the process is challenging? I mean, obviously there's a ton of things that are challenging, but when you think about somebody who's getting into it for the first time, what's the hardest part of it in your mind?
I think the hardest part of it is figuring out. Now I won't say figuring out the fit. I would say the hardest part of it is understanding the volume in which you have to do it and how much work you have to put in to each individual in order to try to secure a commitment. And a lot of that, I think the biggest adjustment is all the follow-up and how organized you have to be with each individual recruit that you're going after. And I think the consistent follow-up and the approach is probably the biggest learning curve. And I think along with being a head coach and being an assistant is probably figuring out the fit of each school, right? Like, you don't want to waste too much time on guys that aren't a great fit, whether it be academically, socially, too far from home, too close to home. And trying to weed through that is probably some of the bigger learning curves that, at least I think.
How long does it take you as you go from one school to another to adapt and understand what a player looks like for that school or that level so that they can play at the school? If this question makes any sense, I always think it's, you know, when you're looking at players and you're like, okay, is this kid a Division II kid? Is he a Division III kid? Is he high level where he's going to come in and be a guy that you can build your team around at the Division III? Is he a role player? Just how do you get a feel for that? Or what's your thought process as you're evaluating a player, trying to figure out, can this guy contribute to our team, our program, especially when you go from one school to another?
I think the one thing that has helped me transition to becoming a head coach is I was an assistant at a bunch of different spots. And I encourage young assistants, like, it's okay to take new opportunities after a year, after 2 years, because you get to learn from somebody different. You get to recruit to a new school, which challenges you. It gets you out of your comfort zone. And I also think, too, it shows other people that you know, people are willing to hire you and they want you. So I think that's a good thing in terms of your networking and trying to move up. But I think, you know, how long you mentioned, it takes a little while. I definitely think everywhere I've been, it's at least a few months trying to figure out. I think once you get into like practice and games at the school that in which you're at, you can kind of get a sense of like, okay, like these are the impact players on our program, seeing them a day in and day out. So when you go and recruit, you kind of have a better idea of like, okay, that kid can be a program guy. It might take him a couple of years to make an impact. Whereas like that kid can really help us, but he might be a borderline scholarship player, but it's probably worth our time still recruiting him. There's no perfect science like to this. It's you just try to kind of just trust your judgment, trust your evaluation, and kind of see where it lands you.
All right. So after Connecticut, you end up at two pretty high academic institutions in Vassar and NYU. What was it like coaching at those two places where the academics are clearly and a huge and important factor in who you're able to recruit and then what those kids are like when you're coaching them? What did you like about that experience coaching at those high academic universities?
Well, it was definitely an adjustment because every room that you're in with the players, I mean, well, spade to spade, they're all smarter than you, right? Like at the time at Vassar, I mean, we couldn't, below a 30 ACT was almost too low for us to recruit. And so now you're dealing with like the upper echelon students, not only from a basketball standpoint, just like in general. But it was pretty neat. Like, you know, the biggest thing at those schools were the first thing you had to figure out was the student admissible, right? At a lot of places, you have to figure out, can that guy play for you? But the first thing at those schools I thought was important was like, all right, can this guy get admitted? Is he admissible to the school? But it was pretty neat. It was pretty unique. I spent a year at Vassar and then two over at NYU. I can often remember, though, like sitting there at team meals and listening to some of their conversations, right? And their conversations about, like, you know, finance or what they're going to do in life after college was so far advanced compared to like when I was 19 or 20. it was wild. But it was cool. So at Vassar, the year that I was there, I had worked for BJ Dunn, who I later worked with again at Gettysburg, and we've developed an amazing friendship. And you know, it's still to this day, he's one of my closest friends. But at Vassar, that was my year there was his first recruiting class. That were freshmen, and there was like five of those guys, and it was really neat. So like that they took up, you know, 5 of 13 guys on the roster, and I feel like those guys really took to me, and I still have pretty good relationships with all of them, even to this day, despite only being there 1 year.
It's cool when you think about those relationships that you build. I think as a coach, it's something that I think most coaches, especially today, even more so maybe than in the past, really value those relationships, and not just the relationships in the moment, but the relationships as players graduate and coaches move on in their career and players get jobs and have families. And those connections, I think, are really, when you talk about reasons why you coach, obviously the challenge of coaching basketball and the competitiveness and all that, I think, plays into it. But clearly the relationships that you can build with players, I think, are something that across the board with coaches that we've talked to on the podcast, one of the things that they always talk about, especially today, is just those relationships that you can build with players are just tremendously special. And I think when you start talking about the experiences that you've had, even in just being there for one season or two seasons where you're not even there for the entirety of that player's coaching career, but yet you're still able to have that impact, I mean, it's powerful stuff what we can do as coaches. And it's always fun for me to be able to hear guys like yourself talk about how important that relationship piece is for them. So as you're in those two places, when do you start looking for head coaching jobs? Is that something that you're consciously looking for during your time here at Vassar and NYU, or where are you at in sort of your career thought process at this point?
Yeah. And to go off your point too, like, you know, as much as we as coaches try to make an impact on the players that we coach, I'm thankful because I feel like the players that I've coached have impacted my life and my career way more than I ever could for them. They've given me great perspective, and honestly, just like great joy in the 10 years I've been doing this. So as much as I try to help them and impact them, they probably have no idea how much in a positive way they've impacted me as a person. But, you know, I was never, I would say, in a rush, I guess, to become a head coach, even though it happened, I guess, pretty young. I did really enjoy being an assistant. I felt like I wasn't the bad cop, which was always nice. and I felt like I was able to develop, you know, pretty good relationships with the players. I really liked getting in the gym with them in off hours and working, you know, getting up shots, working on their game. I really liked the grunt work of like the recruiting aspect, the scouting. I did really enjoy that. So I was never really in a rush to become a head coach. But I guess the one experience that I had that I was like, wow, now I really want to do this was after my second year at NYU, our head coach, Coach Neshi, had retired. And the new coach who came in, decided to bring in his own guys, which I totally understand. But in that period, BJ Dunn had left Vassar for Gettysburg and the head coaching job opened up there. And I obviously didn't land the job, but I was able to go to campus for an interview. And I remember going through that whole process and you start thinking about your ideas, your philosophies, how you would run a program. It got me so excited about the potential opportunity. And I guess when that opportunity presented itself, despite the fact that I didn't get it, that's when I really started being like, okay, I want to be a head coach. And I was still young at that time. I think I was 27, 28, but that's when the wheels started really turning, I guess.
Did you start putting together a portfolio, for lack of a better way of saying it, of just your thoughts and maybe things that you'd collected and ideas when it came to what you wanted to do with your program? Was that something that you started doing at this point?
I did. And I, honestly, if I could go back, and I would encourage all young assistants to do this, I wish I would have started from day one with, you know, being more organized with, you know, collecting practice plans and starting to like watch film in a way of like, okay, if I ran a program, would I run this, kind of create like a video library, which a lot of guys do now on social media, which is awesome. It helps coaches around the country. But yes, at that point I started putting together, I guess, a little bit of a coaching packet, starting to really, you know, wrap my head around ideas. You know, if I ever got the chance to take over a program, how would I run the program? But to be honest, you really never know until you're in that position, right? And I always remember I asked mentors, like, how would I know when I'm ready? And they were like, you just got to do it and figure it out and kind of learn as you go, right? I don't suggest doing it day one. Not that that opportunity presents itself a lot, but I guess the best way to learn is on as you're doing it.
That's like being a parent, Mike. It's exactly the same.
I'm not there yet, so.
I don't think you're ever, well, let me just give you some advice. You're never going to feel like you're ready. At least I never did. And then once you do it, you kind of have no idea what you're doing. You talk to people and you try to figure out, hey, am I doing this right? What am I doing? And you realize very, very quickly that everybody is just kind of flying by the seat of their pants and trying to figure it out. And I think, in a lot of ways, you know, I love what you said there about you don't know what you're going to do or exactly how you're going to do it until you're there, right? Because you can think about what you want to do as a parent or what your kid is going to be like, and you can think about your basketball program and what it's going to be like and what you want to do. And yet there's always circumstances, there's always things that pop up that you didn't foresee or things that just were there, but you didn't realize you were going to have to deal with them. And I think that both from a parenting standpoint and a coaching standpoint, I think there's a lot of similarities there in that you have to really be immersed in the job. I've talked to so many assistants that have said, you know, when I was sitting one seat over, I had all the answers and I just thought it was as easy as, hey, here's this suggestion, or here's what we need to do to win this game, or here's what the program needs in order to turn around. And then when I became a head coach, suddenly I realized that those decisions are way more complex than what I thought they were as an assistant. So when you got the job at St. Joseph's, first time as a head coach, what were one or two things that really leaped out at you? Like, ooh, I didn't know that this was going to be quite as complicated as it is as a head coach. Is there anything that kind of fit that bill?
So it's funny, when I got the call and I accepted the job, I mean, I was ecstatic. Like, because St. Joe's back on Long Island, I was moving back home. And that's so rare, I feel like, in coaching, the chance to like move back to where you grew up to become a head coach. So I was calling everybody, I'm moving back, and head coach. And then I remember laying in bed that night at like 1 o'clock in the morning, just like startling me. And I was like, uh-oh, like this is happening. This is happening.
Now everybody knows I'm coming home.
Now everybody knows I'm coming home. Everything you wanted is happening. And here we go. Like, this is your thing now. And I remember when I took the job there, it was spring, it was April, May of 2019. And we only had like 7 or 8 players in the program. And I remember at that point, I was like, all right, we have a lot of work ahead of us. And then I just try to take it one day at a time, a lot easier said than done. But in that moment I was like, all right, like, and the other thing that I think, you know, is what you don't every decision falls on you, right, as a head coach. Whereas, like you were mentioning before, as an assistant, you're kind of the suggester. You're not the one making the final call in a lot of situations. Whereas a head coach, every final decision is yours. And that takes a little while to get used to.
I'm sure, though, once you get used to it, that ability to be able to shape your program, shape your team in the way that you want it to, I'm sure that was and continues to be one of the best parts of being a head coach, is just being able to take an idea from your mind or from the paper or from wherever you get that idea, and then actually see it play out within your program, with your team, with your kids. I can only imagine how gratifying that is, and just from day one and then continuing on to where you are today.
It's a lot of fun. I think the biggest thing too is like trying to just be a consistent learner, right? Like I definitely don't know everything. So I'm always trying to absorb different knowledge from different people. And it's funny, like when you decide to do something and it doesn't work, like it's not the end of the world. You just try to figure out something else and put your fingerprint on it. That part of the job is a lot of fun. It's stressful. Especially, you know, cause we're all competitive. We all want our programs to run and be successful. But it's, as much as it is stressful, it's even more fun.
How do you continue to learn and grow? What are you doing? Where do you prefer to watch, grab film and watch? Are you watching other college programs at your level? Are you watching Division I programs? Are you watching NBA? Are you watching overseas? Are you talking to mentors? Are you reading? What's your process when you talk about getting better and having that growth mindset and continuing to improve? How do you do that day in, day out in the off season? What's that process look like for you?
Yeah. So right now it's been in the spring, it's been a little bit more challenging in the sense that we're just trying to finish up recruiting. And I like to finish up recruiting before I really start focusing it on like, okay, like how are we going to play next year? Right. Cause it all is based on players. My advice would be to any first time head coach is like figure out like three or four guys at your level that you really trust and that you can bounce ideas off of. So for instance, you know, for me, like BJ Dunn at Gettysburg is somebody I consistently rely on. I use a lot of his ideologies and implementing them into our program. Taylor Roth at Hiram, like I call him all the time, text him questions all the time. Like, hey, how would you handle this situation? Because those are the guys where it's most relevant. And if you can find guys that you trust and can lean on, I think that's super important. But I'm all over the place in terms of my learning. Podcasts, I think, are extremely valuable. I think, you know, and also kind of branching out to watching film when you're watching college basketball, taking notes, going back on Synergy and, you know, rewatching those games. And then somebody I got connected with over during COVID was Ryan Pannone, who was just hired by Alabama as an assistant. He was at New Orleans for the Pelicans last year as an assistant, but he's been around at a bunch of different places. But during COVID, he had put on one of those coaching clinics online. At the time, he was with Hapoel Jerusalem, and he put on a clinic about the 32 pick and roll offense, and it was very unique and European. It was basically trying to figure out a system, the pick and roll system, with playing with two bigs, which is unusual nowadays, and playing with two bigs who are good passer, but not particularly good shooters, right? Everybody plays with a stretch four
right
nowadays, but he had this offense where if you play with two bigs, good passers. And I just became enamored by the offense. And I remember I sent him an email. Kevin Hopkins at Muhlenberg suggested, he's like, hey, here's his email. If you want to reach out, he's very good at helping coaches. And I sent him an email expecting no response. And within an hour, he sent me back his cell phone number. He's like, call me anytime. And now I talk to him on a pretty consistent basis. He's always sharing film with me. And at least a couple of times in the offseason, I'll call him and kind of bounce my ideas off of him. And he's almost like my offensive therapist, if you would. And it's funny, we've never met. He probably doesn't even know to the extent of the impact he's had and how much of a help he's been. But I feel like he's such an unbelievable offensive mind, and he's so willing to help other coaches, which is awesome.
Yeah, Ryan's great. We had him on, I don't know how long ago it's been, probably maybe 2 years ago. I really enjoyed the conversation with him. And obviously, he's worked at all different levels of the game, which I think is something that when you talk about a diversity of background, which you mentioned earlier, and being able to learn from different coaches, you talk about learning from different levels and being in the G League and being in minor league and being in the college game and then being with the Pelicans this past year and just the different things that you pick up working with different coaches and working at different levels. And then it's amazing when you say, hey, I've never met the guy in person, and yet you consider him to be one of your most important mentors. I mean, that's a huge, it's incredible when you think about what the power, we talked earlier about social media, right? And there's good and bad to it. But when you talk about a situation like this, where here's a guy that 20 or 30 years ago, what you'd had to call him on the phone, and the odds of you guys meeting up and actually becoming friends were probably next to nothing. And now it's just so easy to be able to hop on and do a Zoom or just be able to connect with somebody, and then to be able to share, like you can share film, you can share video. It's so much easier than it was back in the day to be able to do that. So I think it's powerful when you start talking about learning as a coach. There's just so many more avenues to be able to get better as a coach than there was 20 or 30 years ago, where we just didn't have the power to connect to the internet the way we do today.
I agree. I think it's the hard thing almost is filtering all the information.
Absolutely.
When you watch all these videos, it's like, okay, I want to press like VCU. I want to run offense like UConn. I want to have my timeout structured like Brad Stevens. Like, and at the end of the day, it's probably not realistic, right? So, and it's probably not translatable to your program. So it's filtering out like all these amazing ideas and ideologies and figuring out like, A, what are you comfortable coaching? And then B, would it even help your team? And that's, I think that's like such a fun challenge in what we do.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think it's really easy when you go and you want to learn whatever. And I think you can say this as a player. I've often said that, you know, when I was a kid, I did basically the same workout every single day from the time I was in 9th or 10th grade until I graduated from college. I had two workouts, one I did by myself and one that I did if I had somebody that was willing to shoot with me. And so those are my two workouts. I did the same exact drills and never varied from any of that stuff. And now you look at what kids have access to. And to your point, you go on there and there's 10 bazillion ball handling drills and there's a million shooting drills and there's all this stuff. And you got to be able to filter it. And I think from a coaching standpoint, it's the same way. You can go on and be like, oh, I love that action, or wow, that's really something that looks cool. And I'd really like to try that. And then you start thinking about it and you're like, you know, you really got to get good at 2, 3, 4 things. And all the rest of this other stuff looks really good. Looks like it'd be a lot of fun. But to your point, you really do have to be able to filter that stuff out and understand what you're all about as a coach, what you feel comfortable with coaching. And when you talk about that part of it and you talk about coaching philosophy and what type of offense you want to run, what type of defensive team you want to be, when did you feel like, and maybe the answer is, I think probably in some cases it might be never, but when did you feel comfortable with, hey, this is who I am as a coach, and this is kind of the style that, again, given my personnel, this is sort of ideally how I'd like to play. When did you feel like you had a grasp on that?
Yeah, so it's I've been a head coach for 4 years, 3 seasons during the COVID year at St. Joe's. We didn't play any games. But during that year, we had the chance to practice in the spring about 15 times or so. But you got to spend all winter thinking about, all right, like next year, hopefully when we play, because right back then it was kind of still the unknown. How would we want to play? You know, and I always try to structure our offense and our defense around the personnel that we have. And I think it's at least important for me to be flexible. And then try not to overhaul things year to year, like give it a chance for the guys to get better at it. And give a chance, give them a chance to develop within the system. But it's funny, like, you know, going into being a head coach, I thought, you know, man to man was always going to be kind of like the calling card for us defensively, pack line, tough, you know, all these different things. And then for the last two seasons as a head coach, we haven't played a possession of man-to-man. We've played all 2-3 zone, right? So it's funny just how it kind of all transpires. And and then it's fun to go back to the drawing board each offseason and okay, was that the best? Did we put our team in the best position to be successful? What's the plan going to be going forward? And I think so much of it has to do with personnel, and everybody says it, but it's so true. Like, it's all about players. Like,
right.
Good players make coaches look better, and they're the ones who make the shots. They're the ones who affect the game defensively. And you just try to put them in the right positions to be successful and then get out of the way, right? Like, try to not overload them with information.
I think it's a really good point that you make about not completely overhauling your system every single year, but allowing it to build. I'm pretty sure it was Jason Zimmerman from Emory who we had on recently who said that you can't do that because when you do, then you never really build an experienced team. It's like every year you don't ever have seniors because you don't have guys that have gone through. If you're changing your philosophy every single year, and that's not to say that you're not tweaking things and making it fit, but if every year you're like, okay, this year we're going to play 2-3 zone and next season we're going to play man. And the next season after that, well, that didn't work. So we're going to press. And so your team never develops that identity. And I thought that was a really good point that he made. And you obviously made the same one. And I think it's when you start talking about trying to put together a great team, obviously the more experience your team gets and the better your upperclassmen are, the better off you're going to be when it comes to winning and losing out there on the court.
Yeah, it's a great point Coach made. I mean, he's one of the best coaches out there. And it's a great point. Like, if you overhaul everything every single year, you're basically, despite the guys being older, you're almost dealing with freshmen and teaching them a new way of playing. But I do think tweaking is important. And it's also, again, like, that's, for me at least, one of the more enjoyable parts of coaching is, like, just trying to rack your brain and figure out the best way to play.
Absolutely. All right. So you're at St. Joe's on Long Island, your home. Why Drew? What about Drew University made it a job that was appealing to you to leave a job in your home where you're from?
Yeah. So leaving was hard. Like, it definitely, I remember when I told the guys I was leaving, it was a lot of emotions, a lot of tears. I mean, basically, you know, we kind of rebuilt the program from the ground up. And the unique thing about St. Joe's is there's no dorms there. So all of those players are commuters. So we had guys, I mean, some guys live 10 minutes from campus, but, you know, we had other guys who were committing to us and driving 50 minutes every single day to practice to school. And my concern taking over that job was like, all right, how are we going to build a good team culture when everybody just like disperses after practice?
But right.
That group was extremely close. And I think maybe because they were kind of all in it together, but we recruited really good guys, really high character guys who we knew would be willing to work hard and was super excited what we accomplished in a short time there. But then when Coach Keckler left Drew and took the job at Moravian, I had been here before. When I was at NYU, we had played here in their tip-off tournament, the Rose City Classic. And look, like, you know, life comes into play. And you know, my now fiance has a really good job on Long Island at the Merchant Marine Academy. So I knew if I took another step in my career, it wasn't going to be across the country. I think that part of my life is over. So I kind of like drew a big circle on the map and it was like, all right, like if jobs open within these areas, let me at least go for them and see kind of where it takes me. And I applied to Drew and I honestly speaking, I didn't think I was going to get even an interview. And luckily I was able to land a Zoom interview, which kind of led to the on-campus portion and then being offered the job. But I remember going through the process, becoming more and more excited about the job. I think the biggest thing from that kind of like led me to this, to really wanting it was that, you know, they had a lot of recent success. Coach Keckler did an awesome job building up the program, especially the last 6 or 7 years. They've been really good. but the area in which Drew is located is really unique. Like the campus is beautiful, but the surrounding towns, Morristown, Madison, have a lot going on, very close proximity to the city, and thought that from a recruiting standpoint, we have a lot to offer, which kind of made the job a little bit more attractive.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
What were some questions that you had for the administration at Drew during the interview process that you wanted to have answered to make sure that you felt like it was the right fit for you?
I think one of the questions I had for them was, you know, what are your expectations for the new coach? Right. And I think kind of clearing the air and figuring out like what their expectations are as a department, you know, as a department in a whole, but also from the new basketball coach is super important, because not that you're afraid of any challenge, right? But if I asked that question and they were like, we want to win a national championship next year, well, I don't know if that's possible, right? Like, who knows, maybe at some point like that, all the stars align and that becomes a reality. But I don't think you want to walk into a situation where expectations are not attainable. I felt very comfortable with, and I thought those were realistic things to achieve.
When you come in and you look around and you try to figure out, okay, what's my plan? So you had done this once at St. Joseph's. Now you're in your second stint as a head coach. What were some of the first things that you needed to do, wanted to do, had to do when you got the job? I'm assuming that meeting with the returning players was probably high on your list, but along with that, maybe you talk about what that process was like, but if there's something else that you felt like, okay, in the first week or two, I got to get this done to kind of get us off on the right foot as we start building what we hope is going to be a really successful program.
The first thing was when I got the job, and this kind of came up in the interview process, was four of our best players were in the transfer portal. So Howie McBurney, who is graduating this year, 20 points, 11 rebounds, first team all conference, first team all met in the transfer portal. Malcolm Newman, returning second team all conference guard in the transfer portal. Andrew Turco, this year he shot 40% from three. So you got a lot of good players in the transfer portal. So I was like, all right, I have to re-recruit those guys, right? And I remember that was the main focus. And luckily for us, all four of them decided to stay. So then I felt comfortable about taking the next steps, which was getting on the phone with every single one of those guys, and just trying to get to know them on a little bit of a deeper level, and just have casual conversations, you know, like, why did you choose Drew? What about the program? Are you excited about going forward? Because I got the job in the summer, so I knew I wouldn't see a lot of these guys face to face until the school year started.
What were some of the things they told you about why they had chosen Drew in the first place that you felt like, okay, I can see what the positives are, why they came here? What do you remember them telling you about that?
Everybody answered this question the same, but in a different way, if that makes sense. So it all came back to the players, right? Like, I chose Drew because on my visit, they made me feel like family, and I saw how well they all got along with each other, and I wanted to be a part of that. And that answer was the same, just worded differently from everybody I talked to. And I felt like from that cultural aspect, I was like, wow, this must be a really good place to be. And since I've been here, that has remained true. Like, we have really good guys in our program, just very welcoming, very easy to be around. And the school is the same way. But I just was like, at one point I asked them, I was like, did you guys plan this answer? Like, you're all saying the same thing, but, you know, it's just, and I've noticed it too firsthand, like when we have recruits visit campus, like our guys are just natural, and making them feel welcome, making them feel comfortable. And I knew like, okay, that they have something special in that regard here too.
When you get the job, how do you go about figuring out what you need to do in terms of recruiting, looking at your roster? What was that first year of recruiting like?
Yeah. So we're still in the midst of it right now. We actually got a commit about an hour ago, so we're pretty excited about that.
Nice.
Yeah, thanks. But you know, when I got the job, we had so many players on the roster. I'm talking north of 20. So we kind of had an idea of what we needed to like, of the type of player we needed to recruit. It's just, we didn't really know the number of guys that we needed to bring in until we started our season and kind of to figure out like, all right, these are where we might see some holes. And that probably put us beyond the eight ball a little bit. And I think, you know, I probably wish we would have spent a little bit more time kind of like racking our brains around about that a little bit earlier in the year. But it's a challenge when you have so many guys, even though we graduated six guys, having a roster north of 20, trying to figure out how many guys you're looking to bring in is definitely a challenge in and of itself.
How do you feel about the difference in watching a kid with their high school team versus their AAU team? And how much do you weigh one versus the other? Just, I think it's probably shifted. Again, something that's changed over the last 15 or 20 years is, you know, when you were being recruited or when I was being recruited, certainly the high school season and the high school coach was more important in the process. And I think now talking to a lot of coaches, just because of the ease of being able to see a whole bunch of players at once and also seeing those players play with and against a lot of other high level players, that AAU is sort of maybe taking precedence. So just how do you look at that balance between evaluating a kid with their high school team versus with their AAU team?
I think you nailed it by saying it's definitely a balance. You know, seeing them over the summer with their AAU team is extremely valuable. Like you mentioned, they're playing with really good players, right? Sometimes when you go to a high school game, maybe there's two players on each team that can really go. And a lot of times when you go to an AAU game, all of those players in the court are aspiring to be college players. So typically all those guys can really play. So you're seeing them play with really good players, against really good players. And then in the spring and summer, it's just natural. Like, we have more time to go out and watch these guys, whereas opposed to our season, you know, we get a week off around Christmas, but we really have to carve out time to go watch them with their high school team. The challenge, I think, sometimes with AAU is they play so many games in a weekend where it's hard to see them play at a consistently high level in terms of their motor over and over again if they're playing three or four games in a weekend, which is just natural, right? That's where I like to go watch them with their high school team, because especially as we get closer to the playoffs, it's a little bit more pressure, a little bit more crowd influence. And typically they're going to be one of the couple better players in their team. So maybe it's an opportunity for them to like showcase what they can do a little bit more offensively and have a little bit more of an impact on the game in a totality.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I think it's one of those things that you want to just see them in as many different environments as you can so you can get a full evaluation on who they are as a player. What about in terms of the intangible things that you're looking for? Obviously, fitting them into your culture. And you mentioned about when you bring them on campus that your guys give you a pretty good feel for, hey, what this kid is all about. And we think he'd be a good fit, or we think he wouldn't be a good fit. But what are some things that you personally look for that you value in a player beyond just the talent that they have on the floor?
I think the biggest thing is the motor in which they play with. I just think if they play hard with their AAU team and they play hard consistently with their high school team, regardless, I guess, of how many minutes they're getting. Usually with their high school team, they're going to play a majority of the game. Sometimes with the AAU team, they might play half the game. And I think what the motor translates to is how passionate they are for the game. And I think you really need to love it at the Division III level to see it through and to be a really good player. Because it's a long season, right? There's no scholarship binding you to being on the team. You know, I mean, you get an academic merit scholarship, like whether you stay in the team or not, like you're still going to get that to go to the school. So I think just trying to figure out in the process, like, does this guy really love basketball from a genuine level? And you don't always nail it, right? Recruiting is not, like I said before, it's not a science or a perfect equation. But I feel like if you can get more guys in your program who genuinely love it, who want to be in the gym, who want to get better, I do feel like you have a better chance of being good consistently, which is really hard to do at this level. I mean, I've been blown away. You mentioned Coach Zimmerman before, like they're always good. And that's so hard to do at this level because you consistently have to bring in good recruiting class after good recruiting class without really skipping a beat in there.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the challenge too is, you know, you mentioned it earlier about guys committing early, and there's still with social media, as you said, there's a ton of pressure out there. There's a ton of guys looking, and obviously players are looking for scholarships, right? It's something that they've been hearing probably from their parents and people around them for a long time. And so there, a lot of people are chasing that scholarship, whether that's realistic or unrealistic. And so to be able to consistently get those players, and right, really, if you want to be successful at the Division III level, you're recruiting and you're bringing in guys that are probably scholarship players, and for whatever reason they're able to choose in your school for the academics or the culture or the coach or whatever it might be. And in order to win big at Division III level, you have to recruit players who are probably capable of playing a level above where they're actually playing. And I think that's how you really have success. And as you said, that is really, really hard to do year after year. I mean, you can catch lightning in a bottle once in a while, but somebody who's doing that year after year is doing something right. There's no question about it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's numerous guys who do it. You know, Coach Zimmerman, we mentioned before, Coach Broderick at Nazareth, like his teams are always good. Jason Leone out of Oswego, I mean, they won 28 games this year, 27 games last year at upstate New York State school. I mean, it's just remarkable what he's done. And again, year in and year out, getting good players, getting them to buy in, playing the team game, like, these are all challenges nowadays, and these guys have seemed to nail it. So maybe try to pick their brain a little bit more than I do.
How often when you sit down with your staff and you're talking about a player that you're recruiting, how often is there a general consensus that, hey, this guy's a good fit? I don't know if I'm asking the question quite correctly, but I'm just curious of what the discussion is when you're talking about, hey, is this guy going to be one of the players that we really want to target, that we want to bring in? How much of a consensus is there that, hey, this is the kid that we want to, this is a kid we want to really target?
Well, we talk as a staff pretty consistently. You know, we have consistent fluid conversations. So I think just naturally in those conversations, we're talking about certain guys and like, okay, this is a top guy for us. We feel like he can really help us from day one. We feel like it's a good fit for so many different reasons. So I don't know if we ever sit down and say like, okay, like who are the five top guys? Like we're all just, everybody's kind of on a recruiting board. But I think if we find ourselves talking about certain guys every day, pretty much, I think we all know that they're top targets for us and guys that we need to be consistently on.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right now, at this point where the season's over, obviously at the Division III level, the amount of contact that you can have with your players, you're getting your 8 days here for the first time, which I'm sure as all the D3 guys we've talked to are excited about that. But for the most part, you're limited in the amount of contact that you can have with players on the floor. What are you guys doing right now in the spring to sort of put a bow on last season and then start to prepare for what's going on next year?
Yeah. So I think it's really important to have good leaders in your program. you know, and leaders can come in all forms. They can come in all ages, right? Like when I was at St. Joe's in the spring of 2021, we had named the freshman a captain, right? We just thought he was mature, kind of got what we were, kind of understood what we were trying to do as a program, was very bought in. I think he commanded the room, and I think it was a decision at the time where it kind of maybe throwing some people off, but he ran with it and he's still a captain there now and doing a great job. But again, I think it's really important to have great leaders and guys who are willing to hold their teammates accountable. You know, I'm a firm believer when the season is over, trying to give them some space, you know, time away, especially right when the season ends, like emotions are high. So I give them 3 weeks, honestly, 3 weeks to a month off. And then after spring break, we meet with each guy individually, kind of have wrap up exit meetings. And in those exit meetings, we give them questions ahead of time, usually 7 or 8 questions. And we give them the questions ahead of time and let them kind of think about, you know, their experience, right? So we ask them different things. You know, what did you like? What does the coaching staff have in place that helps you and your teammates? What can the coaching staff do differently to help you and your teammates? What do you think your strengths are? What do you think your weaknesses are? Just so there's a lot of back and forth in those meetings. I never found it useful if a coach just sat a player down and told him how he felt the season went, never asked for the player's feedback, especially in the current climate. And I think it's important to get their feedback. And also too, it's interesting, like what they say, you know, and sometimes if you're hearing a consistent message, maybe it's time to look in the mirror in what they're talking about. It's also too, it's funny, like when you ask somebody what their strengths are and they say shooting and they shot 22% from three on the year, maybe it's a great opportunity to kind of bridge the gap and have a conversation. And we always tell them when we go into those meetings, it's okay if we're not on the same page, but let's do our absolute best in this meeting to leave here on the same page and to give you a plan going forward. But then in the spring, we're just checking on guys. I know they're playing pickup and they're getting their work in, but more of just being here as a sounding board and a support system for them before they head into the summer.
How do guys at your level, how do they get better and where do they find games to play in the off season? I know that this is something that has definitely changed. I think back to when I was a player, again, this is a long, long time ago, but there was pickup games everywhere. I could go and play outdoors. I could play indoors. There was good high school players, good college players, good adult players that you could find pickup games. And now it feels like the ability to find a good pickup game with high school or college players, unless you're actually on a college campus, I think is really a challenge. So when your guys go home for the summer, what do they do when you're checking in with them and talking about, hey, how are you getting better? What are those guys doing? Where are they finding games? How are they working on their game in the off season?
I think it's definitely important to have those conversations before the summer, right? To kind of get a sense of like where their head's at. Like, okay, like you have a gym to work out in, do you have a place to get shots up? And it's okay to get shots up outside. I know that's kind of seems like a foreign concept to a lot of guys now, but you have a wing to play, you have consistent pickup, and if they don't, then you know we try to locate places for them to play. We try to get in touch with our resources, our network. I think pickup is summer pickup with plenty of other college guys, older guys, is the best. I think leagues are fun. There's definitely some good value in those leagues too. But if you can find a really good pickup game as a college player, because you can play for longer periods of time, you can get your conditioning better. You can guard different guys. You can try different things without having a result attached. And I think that's good. Our guys, the local guys at least play in a summer league together, 6 or 7 guys. So that's good. You know, they're able to see each other, play with each other in summer league. And there's some other colleges who do the same thing in and around this area. So I think the biggest thing is as long as they're playing consistently, lifting, and they're working on their game, because, you know, it's a reality. Like so much is team focused between October and March, that there's a lot of time to get better as a player. And again, the guys who are consistently willing to put in the work in the gym and are passionate about it seem to find a lot of success in Division III.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like when you're not the playing field, I don't want to say the playing field is not even, but when you're talking about the higher levels where they have more access, you think about at the Division I level, the amount of access that players have to coaches have to players. It's almost like it's got to be really hard to make a jump compared to your teammates, because you're basically, everybody's doing the same thing. Whereas at the Division III level, there's, I'm sure, a separator where guys who put in a lot more time and a lot more work, you can see them grow from somebody who maybe is out of the rotation to somebody who becomes a really important player all in the course of one summer, just because, again, they're not all doing that same workout. They're not all in getting the same amount of work with the coaching staff. They kind of got to figure it out and put that work in on their own. And it's sort of a, again, and sort of an old school way of looking at things in terms of just being able to improve and grow and get better in the summertime, which is the way that I think we used to think about players getting better from one season to the other and sort of taking that leap and improving. And I'm sure you've seen it over the course of your different experiences at the different places that you've been from a coaching standpoint. So I think one of the things that people always wonder about is, okay, Division III, you don't have access to your players. Your season ends sometime in March. You don't start up practice again until October 15th. What are you doing from March to October? So let's say it's a average day in June. What are you doing in the office working to try to prepare for the next season? What does a typical day look like kind of in the off season? I know there probably isn't a typical day, but just what are some of the tasks that you're trying to get done in the off season?
I think the biggest challenge for me is trying to find a consistent workout plan to clear my head. I think I have it figured out now, but trying to keep that going forward. I don't know. I think it's important to be an example for your players. It's if you're going to ask them to be in shape and, to show up in shape. I think if you're young enough and you're healthy enough, I think it's important if you are that example for them. But no, on a more serious note, recruiting every day is the lifeblood of, I would say, most college programs, right? Like, players are the one who win games. And I think players too are the ones who dictate the culture and what you're trying to create, right? Like, the unique thing about recruiting, everybody talks about culture and what the culture you're trying to build. The unique thing about recruiting is, like, you have a strong say in, like, the type of players you're bringing in that can influence your culture, right? From a character standpoint as well. So I think recruiting really never stops. There's really never a day off from doing it. But I think it's important to be organized in the off season, because you can get kind of shuffled around and trying to accomplish too many different things. But in a typical day in June, I think at that point is when we're starting to figure out, all right, how are we going to look to play next year? And I kind of like to break it down into different areas within our program. So, like, practice structure, offensively, half court offense, full court offense, half court defense, full court defense, and kind of take time to kind of narrow in on each of those, right? Like, it's not offense one day, defense the next. So we might really, like, lock in on offense for, like, the whole month of June, and really try to figure out how we're going to play. And then when July hits, move on to the defense side of the ball. And then you get into specials, sideline out of bounds, baseline out of bounds, end of game, and just trying to be super organized as you head into October, or now I guess we can do it in September, which I think is probably throwing a lot of Division III coaches for a loop, having these extra 8 days. We're not going to know what to do with ourselves.
Do you know what you're doing with them? Have you figured out kind of what the plan is?
I haven't. I have an idea of how I want to structure the days. I kind of want to build our guys up a little bit before we start the 15th. So I think we might do like a two day week, a 3 day week, and a 3 day week before we really get going, just to kind of build up their legs. And, you know, I think we do want to spend a lot of time with player development, because when October 15th hits, like, we're going to have 3 weeks before our first game. And it's really hard to spend a lot of time with the individual. So I think maybe taking, you know, parts of these 8 days to really work on their footwork, work on their fundamentals, kind of break it down slowly for them, so that when the 15th hits, like, everything is not completely new to them. But I think the biggest thing in the off season is being organized, creating a to-do list, like a monthly plan, a daily plan, and just trying to stay on task to because when the 15th hits, I mean, the rest of your life kind of shuts down a little bit.
What's your practice planning look like for you? How do you sit down? When do you sit down? Are you doing it as a staff? Do you come up with it first and then share it with the staff? Just what's the process for putting together a practice?
Sure. So for the first practice, I mean, I start thinking about it way too far in advance. I'm just too excited. And it's probably not the best use of my time, but I create a document on my computer leading up until our first game. And it's like, all right, these are the things that we have to get in before our first game. And we try to keep it to a very basic level, right? We don't want to overload the guys. We don't want to rush things in, but like you need a press break before the first game in case a team presses, right? So like we have to make sure that's in. Like you have to have a certain amount of baseline and advance plays. You have to make sure you have half court sets that you want to get to in those situations. But so we create that document, and then we create a little bit of a longer document of like, all right, what are we trying to get in by Christmas? And then it never fails. Like after the first day or two, like you have to go back to it and like rearrange it a little bit, but at least you have an idea of what you're trying to input as the season goes on. And then with practice, I spend an awful lot of time thinking about practice. I think the one thing I'm trying to get better at as a coach is like, as the season goes on, not being as repetitive with our practice plans, trying to create like a little bit different, create a little bit of a different look for our guys. But usually when practice ends, I come back to the office, we talk about practice, how we think it went. And then I spend a couple, at least an hour, at least writing down the ideas of what I want to do for tomorrow and kind of revisiting it the next morning, right? Like you write down your ideas kind of in the emotional state. All right, this is what I want to try to accomplish tomorrow. And then when we come back to it in the morning, then I spend a couple hours, 2 to 3 hours planning practice, and we're trying to get the most out of our time on the court. You know, we rarely ever exceed 2 hours. And then as the season goes on, we even, you know, cut that down quite a bit. So just trying to maximize our time. And we spend a lot of time trying to make sure we're organized. The one thing about practice that I think I struggled with as a first year head coach, I wanted it to be perfect, right? Like I wanted all the drills to run smoothly. I wanted all of our live play to look good. And I got so caught up in my first year, like it has to be clean to the eye. And I remember listening to like Chris Oliver's podcast and him talking about like, it's supposed to be messy, right? This whole idea of like practice is supposed to be messy because that's how the game is. And the game is very unpredictable. A lot of things happen in the course of the game that you can't have control of as a coach. So almost creating that environment a little bit in practice forces me to step out of my comfort zone a little bit. But I think it makes it a little bit more game-like for our guys.
That's sometimes hard to do as a coach. I know that obviously has changed over the years in terms of how much do you do the block practice of repetitive, I'm working on this move and I'm just doing it over and over again versus the random and games-based approach that I think is much more prevalent now, that the practices have to look like the games in order for the learning to translate. And yet sometimes I know that as a coach, it's sometimes hard because as you point out that you want things to be perfect. And I've often said on the podcast that I remember my first day as a coach, I coached a JV team and I went into my first practice. And after 5 minutes of the first drill, I was like, oh my God, there was 500 things that they did wrong that I wanted to fix. And I quickly realized that there was no possible way that I was going to be able to fix everything and stop play every time I saw something that I thought should have been done differently. And so you learn, I think, as a coach that you have to deal with some degree of those mistakes and you have to focus in on, okay, what am I looking for in this drill or on this day or in this practice? And some of the other things, not that you're letting them slide, but some things you just have to be able to put to the side for another day so that you can focus on what your main goal is for that practice or for that drill or for that day. And that's, I think, a skill that it takes coaches a lot of time to develop. And to your point, I think you're experiencing it, and I know I still experience it, that it's always a work in progress because I think you're always wanting it to look perfect. It never does, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. I mean, spent so much time the first year, just okay, it's got to be perfect. And then when you watch a game, it's anything but, right? And creating that environment and then picking and choosing like when you're going to stop practice. And I think it takes a little bit of a while to get used to. And, you know, we do one thing in practice, and I think it's we scrimmage a lot. We play a lot. We don't always just like run up and down 5-on-5, but we try to score differently because we're trying to get, again, like to your point, create as much of a game environment practice as we can, right? Because that's what translates. So we try to play a lot of 5-on-5, 4-on-4 in practice because we feel like, doesn't mean we're right, but at least we think it's translatable to the game.
Yeah, no, it makes a ton of sense. And I think it's definitely the way that the game is trending. And I don't think you can really argue with the concept of if you're going to be good in the game, then you want your practices to look as much like the game as they possibly can. And then you start talking about putting in the constraints and sort of focusing the action on particular things that you want to work on. And I think that's where you really get the most bang from your buck with a practice. And that's how you win, is you get the most out of your practices, you develop your players, and you try to get them to be the best that they can be. And that's when you're on your way to having a successful program. We are coming up towards an hour and a half here, Mike. So I want to ask you one final two-part question. Part one is, when you think about the next year or two, what is your biggest challenge? And then part two, when you think about what you get to do every day, what's your biggest joy? So your biggest challenge and followed by your biggest joy.
I think the biggest challenge is just, you know, like I mentioned before, Darrell Keckler had done an amazing job the last 6 or 7 years. They won over 20 games multiple times. They won a conference championship. So it's just trying to move the program in the right direction, keep it at the level that came before me. And that's definitely a challenge. But also, too, we graduated two really good players this year. Howie McBurney, who I mentioned before, over 1,000-point scorer, first-team all-conference player, 6'6", 220, great player. So we graduate him in our second-leading scorer. And then next year, our starting backcourt will be seniors, right? So the challenge is going to be finding guys to replace them. And I'm not saying we're going to find guys that are going to be as good as them, but maybe, you know, maybe they're close and maybe they can develop over time, and being patient as we transition to the next year or two. And then I think the biggest joy that I have found in coaching is kind of like the relationships of the people that you get to interact with every day. The players, our assistant coaches, the people within the athletic department, like to me, that's the best. Like, you know, you mentioned before, like, what do you do on a day in June? Like today I was just bouncing around to different coaches' offices, picking their brain, asking them questions, just having conversations. Like, I feel very fortunate. That's what I get to do for a living, is to be around other coaches, to be around players, to be around good assistants. And it's been, extremely enjoyable over the last 10 years. Like, some of my best friends to this day are people I met through coaching. And I feel like everything good in my life, has come through basketball, whether that be friendships, relationships, people I've met, different experiences. So I feel very lucky in that regard, and hope to keep it going for another however many years.
It's well said. And I think that when you talk about being able to use the game to make an impact on people and build relationships, that's really what it's all about. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you, about your program, whether you want to share social media, email, website, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. So DrewRangers.com, best way to find out about our program. Instagram, Drew_MEV. Another way to find out a little bit more that's going on within our program. But if anybody wants to reach out through email, mcsloy@drew.edu, hopeful to answer any questions that you have, or if I can be a resource in any way, especially to young coaches. I know it's super hard business to break into. So if I can be of a resource, if any way, If I can help along the way, I hope you guys reach out.
Well said. Cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight, Mike, to join us. Really appreciative. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.